Before we begin, we would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of the land on which this work was developed and is presented. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Just another note before we begin. So this whole season, I have never once forgotten to press record or recorded into the wrong device or used the microphone incorrectly. And it seems only fitting that on the final episode, I do just that. So unfortunately, when I pressed record, my microphone was not plugged in properly. And so instead of recording through my nice microphone into my computer, the audio recorded using my computer's speaker, which is really bad. So I'm very sorry, but for the first maybe 6 minutes or so, the audio is going to be really bad. Again, I'm sorry, and this won't happen in season two. Fingers crossed.
Hello there, welcome back to the Community Library. I'm your host, Angauri Rice.
And I'm Harry.
Welcome, Harry. Thank you for being on the podcast. Today, we're going to talk about Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief by Rick Riordan, which we learned is the correct pronunciation. But before we get to speaking about the book, Harry, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
I am very boring. I study science at university, and that's about all I do with my life, other than reading 4 Percy Jackson books in approximately a week, which is too many.
There are worse ways to spend your time, though. It's not that bad.
It really is.
Harry and I met in year 7, which is 6 years ago now.
Almost seven.
Can you believe that? God. But we met, I remember the day, it was a crisp morning. We met doing a run around the park because it was compulsory for sport. And we started talking about Percy Jackson.
Yeah, we bonded. The Greek gods. They brought us together.
Yeah, it was our first spark of a friendship.
Yes.
That was going to last for many years. But I think since that day, we really haven't spoken about Percy Jackson.
Oh, no. Definitely not. Not enough. Not enough.
But now we're going to dedicate a whole hour. Don't worry. Hopefully it won't be that long. A whole hour to speaking about Percy Jackson. So, do we want to get into it?
Yes.
So, our first segment is SparkNotes says. So in this segment, I will give you a quick rundown of the book. So this book follows 12-year-old misfit Percy Jackson, and he discovers one day that he is the son of a powerful Greek god. He goes to camp, called Camp Half-Blood, to protect himself because monsters are following him for some unknown reason. And the people at the camp realize that Zeus's lightning bolt has been stolen. So then Percy and his two sidekicks, Annabeth and Grover, go on a quest to retrieve Zeus's lightning bolt.
Yeah, it's a great time. What more could you ask for, honestly?
And meanwhile, there are like mini quests, monsters following them, lots of water-related action sequences.
Yeah, you know nothing's going to go right. I mean, it basically says it from the outset of the book. But literally nothing goes right.
Do we want to move on to our segment, Judging a Book by Its Cover?
Sure.
In this segment, we talk about the physical book and our reading experience. So Harry and I read the exact same copy because...
And Gary's too cheap to buy her own. She has to use mine.
This is true. This is very true. I ordered it from the library and it was taking ages and I was running out of time, so I stole Harry's copy.
Very rude.
But I might be cheap, but you buy every single book. Like,
okay, I haven't read a book since I was like 12. I used to buy every book that I read, but then I became illiterate and it's fine now.
But like Harry's shelves, no kidding, are just stocked full of like every single book in the Percy Jackson series, like all nice matching paperbacks.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I lie in my bed at night and I just look at them as I fall asleep.
Meanwhile, I borrow books from the library and I support the library. So we both read Harry's copy, which is the movie tie-in edition. People generally hate movie tie-in editions.
Awful. I have the strongest hatred for this book cover. Like, the rest of the series, I have all, like, matching. They're all the same edition. This one's trash. And I'm so angry about it.
So this was made into a film in 2011, starring Logan Lerman. But you can't even tell that it's him on the cover. We have a boy standing in the water, we don't know why, holding a big lightning bolt. And this moment never happens in the book.
It's false advertising. Honestly, it's a lie. It's a scam.
It is. There is never one point where he picks up the lightning bolt and he's like, I might give this a go. Does this happen in the movie? Do you know?
I have no idea. I cannot remember the movie. All I remember is it's terrible.
So this is an interesting copy because it also has a table of contents. I said to Harry that this is a very controversial thing in the book community to have a table of contents in a fiction book. And I know that they did it with the new editions of Harry Potter and people kicked up a fuss because in something like Harry Potter, the titles of the chapters actually kind of spoil what's coming up. With this, it doesn't really spoil it, but like, why do you need a table of contents in a fiction book if you're going to read it in order anyway?
It's almost like a blurb for this book because it sort of summarizes and gives you the gist of both what happens in the book and the tone. So I think, like, from a buying the book sort of standpoint, it makes sense.
Mm.
Not that many people will sort of flip open a fiction book and expect a contents page.
Mm.
But, like, you know, why would you not read I Battle My Jerk Relative and not buy a book, you know? Like, we visit the Garden Gnome Emporium. We get advice from a poodle. Like, quality content.
It's fun, for sure. And also the chapter titles do this thing, which the writing does as well, where it, like, references the reader. It references the fact that it's a book. And Percy Jackson is writing it down in some diary or whatever. It's basically...
Is it narrated by Percy?
Yeah, it's first person.
Oh, it is.
So the book starts out... I just want to read you the first few sentences because I think they're really interesting. The book starts out with, quote, "Look, I didn't want to be a half-blood." "If you're reading this because you think you might be one, my advice is close this book right now. Believe whatever lie your mum or dad told you about your birth and try to lead a normal life." End quote. Oh, and he also says, quote, "If you're a normal kid reading this because you think it's fiction, great, read on. I envy you for being able to believe that none of this ever happened." End quote. How dramatic, right? But it's also like, it's like, hey, like, I'm your friend. We're cool.
It's enticing.
Yeah.
Look, I love Percy Jackson, but this is one of the worst parts of the book, in my opinion. Like, why can't you just let a kid read a book and just let it be a book? Like, it's such, like, a trope of, like, 2000s.
Oh, my God.
This is Editing and Gowrie here, just coming in to say that this is the exact moment that I realized my microphone wasn't plugged in properly and I had been recording everything into my computer. So please enjoy nice audio from now on.
What is it called? I don't know what to call it.
Where you, like, reference the reader.
Yeah, but like pretend like it's real. Like making a fiction a non-fiction when it's not. Like that, it just... I don't know. It just grinds my gears. I have absolutely no reasoning to support this. Like, no reasoning. But it just annoys me.
Don't you think, though, that, like, for a younger reader, say for a 12-year-old kid who's actually not that interested in reading and not interested in the Greek gods, someone is like, hey, read this book. And they're like, oh, Percy Jackson, he's just like my friend. Like, he doesn't take anything too seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I understand using it to entice younger readers because it's targeted at younger people. Mm. But to me, like, the writing should do that for itself. I also think it sort of has that tone anyway. Like, you don't need to do it so explicitly at the beginning of the book. It almost, like, dampens your creativity, you know? Because it's like instead of being like, ooh, like, you know, I could be a half-blood, it's like, oh, you're telling me it's real, like, now I'm gonna, like, think that I'm a half-blood because you told me to think I'm a half-blood. I don't know. That probably makes no sense. But, like...
No, it does. It does. And there are some people who really, really hate that. It's also that thing of, like, it happens in The Neverending Story as well. Did you read that or see the movie? It's like a book within a book, and you're reading the book thinking that you can actually dive into the book. So I love it when books do that. I love it when you have like a book within a book or a world within a world, and you think that it could be real and the book references the reader. I love that, but I understand why some people wouldn't.
I mean, it's also just like, I mean, it's probably because I'm not no 12-year-old boy no more, but like I read this and I'm like, I know that Zeus isn't out there shooting me.
But he could be.
He could be. And I might get blasted to smithereens for talking crap about Zeus. Yeah,
Zeus, I love you. You know, don't kill me. Just kill Harry.
No thunderbolts, please. No thunderbolts. We praise Zeus in this household.
I think it makes the world more real. Because rather than introducing this whole new world and for him to write a book that's about Greek gods in this Greek god world, he brings it into modern times, and so it's easier for kids to connect with it because it's this urban fantasy. There's a hidden layer of another world underneath the world that we know.
Yeah, and that I can appreciate. It's just such like a cliche start.
Yeah.
You know, if I ever picked a book, I mean, obviously, again, I'm not a child anymore, but if I picked up a book that started like that, I would like throw it in the bin. Like, and I love this book, but just that first page, like really, no.
So when you were 12, did you read it and you were like, oh my God, this is the best thing I've ever read?
I mean, I must have, because I bought the whole series. But I reckon even when I was younger reading it, I would have been a bit like, thanks, Rick, but I know that I'm not a half-blood.
Where in the world?
In this segment, we are going to talk about the setting, the limitations, the world building, all of that. So this is set in the US of A. In New York specifically, Percy Jackson goes to a bougie private school in New York. So we have the setting of New York. Then we also have Camp Half-Blood, which is on
Long Island Beach, Long Island Beach. Is that a thing? Yeah.
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 So Percy goes to Camp Half-Blood and it's all like forests and trees and mountains and lakes. He spends the 2 blissful weeks at Camp Half-Blood and then he gets given his first quest. What?
It's a party.
Party time. So he gets his quest. He goes with his feisty girl sidekick, Annabeth, and his comic relief sidekick, Grover. He's a half goat and he's a satyr, if that's how you pronounce it.
Probably not, but like, we can pretend.
We can pretend that that's the correct pronunciation. It's S-A-T-Y-R.
That took you too much to spell it.
If we do a whole series, we're just going to get so much hate for pronouncing all the names wrong.
So many.
He's a satyr. Let's go with that. Yeah. You know, I'm going to stick with it. I'm wrong, but strong. So, where was I going with this? So they go on this road trip to get to Los Angeles because the gods of Olympus are settled over New York and then the underworld is in LA, obviously. But you wanted to talk about how the Greek gods still exist and where they are now and why they're over America, right?
Yeah, so Rick Riordan does this interesting thing where he explains how the Greek gods of Olympus shift with Western civilization, which I think is a pretty interesting way of sort of justifying why they're still around and why they're in America. And I think like it's very convenient for the author to say, oh yeah, well, of course the Greek gods are in America, because you know that means he doesn't need to be sort of jetting 12-year-olds to, you know, ancient Greece. Not ancient Greece, just regular Greece. but it's both a convenient writing tool and it sort of creates an interesting plot point of how they've sort of recontextualized the Greek gods and made them modernized because they fit into this new modern American society, the Western civilization.
For me, it's clearly separated into East Coast and West Coast. And I think in the US, like LA and New York are like the big main cities, right? Their quest is that they have to get from New York to LA without flying in the sky because Zeus owns the sky and Zeus doesn't like Percy. So if they fly, he'll get beaten down by a lightning bolt.
Smited.
Smote.
Smote.
LA and New York are very interesting because they're very opposite cities, at least in my mind. And I think in this book, they're presented as opposite cities. I'm just going to paraphrase this one quote here, where they arrive in LA and Percy says, quote, LA had a totally different feel from New York. Back home, everything seemed close. It didn't matter how big the city was, you couldn't get anywhere without getting lost. The street pattern and the subway made sense. There was a system to how things worked. LA wasn't like that. It was spread out, chaotic, hard to move around, end quote. New York is chosen as the home of the 12 gods, like Mount Olympus, and the underworld is underneath LA, and I find that hilarious. Have you been to LA?
I have, yonks ago, like so long ago. I haven't been to New York, but I do think that it's really funny that they say that LA smells like monsters, and I think that there's a very simple explanation for this. Rick Riordan is from New York.
Hello, this is Editing and Gowrie again, popping in here to say that I googled this and Rick Riordan is actually not from New York. I have no idea where we got this information from or why we thought it was appropriate to use in an episode when we actually didn't have any evidence for that. Turns out Rick Riordan was born in Texas and now lives in Boston, which I guess is kind of close to New York, but this whole argument is founded on the fact that Rick Riordan is from New York, but maybe he just really likes it. I don't know. Anyway, let's get on with the episode.
And like, it's just so obvious because like, it's such a New Yorker thing to do, to be like, New York is the home of the 12 gods. And you know what? LA's full of monsters.
And the underworld. Editing and Gowrie back here. Again, since we have found out that Rick Riordan is actually not from New York, this argument seems a little silly, but maybe he just really likes New York and doesn't like LA. I don't know. Anyway, continue. The entrance to the underworld is a recording studio, which I think is so interesting because it's like directly connected to the film and entertainment industry.
Yeah.
And I think,
damn the media. Down with the media.
Those darned Hollywood people. And
this is your
me.
Hades.
But it is like, it is this trope, I think, or this idea or this misconception that LA is soulless.
Or very full of souls. Depends on how you see it.
Fair point. But I think that Rick Riordan has this interesting use of landscape. Because in my mind, LA is super flat, even though this is not true. But like...
What?
And they have...
Wait, what's your point?
Okay, my point is... Wait, what is my point? Oh, yeah, yeah. My point is. Okay. So in LA, you know, people are probably going to prove me wrong, but most of the buildings are flat and spread out and wide. And this is my perception of LA and how LA is described in the book is spread out and flat and sprawling and close to the ground. And so therefore it's close to the underworld, the depths, the dead people. Meanwhile, New York is full of high-rise buildings.
Yeah,
it's cramped. You have to reach up because there is no floor space, and the Empire State Building reaches up to the clouds to Mount Olympus.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess that does kind of physically make sense to have Mount Olympus on top of like such a tall building, but I mean, duh. But like, also like why not use a mountain, you know? Like why the Empire State Building? I guess it's the hub of New York City.
Well, I think it's interesting that they use these bustling metropolitan cities filled with Greek gods and ancient ideas and deities.
And monsters. Don't forget the monsters.
Sorry, so and the many, monsters!
So many monsters on public transit. Like, the Furies just, like, busting out on a bus and, like, trying to kill some children. And, like, I love that just the whole time Percy cops the blame. You know, like, the whole time it's like, oh, these grandmas are like getting attacked by this 12-year-old boy because that's what the mist is making everyone say. Like, so good. Everyone's like looking for Percy, and then he like jumps off a building and like explodes it a bit.
He's a fugitive.
Yeah. We stan a criminal.
He's a misfit. He's misunderstood. I also love like how everything has been made modern. And the frustrations that people have with the way that things work in the mortal world still carry over into god worlds. The realms of the gods, so for example, Hades underworld, when they go into the entrance to the underworld. It's not really some grand, like, entrance with pillars and columns. It just looks like airport security. It really makes it funny. You know, it takes these ancient ideas that kids might find boring and turns them into things that we can all relate to, like being stuck at airport security. It modernizes it, and I think that it's a great way to get kids into this type of stuff. It's relatable, and you get a real sense of the fact that these Greek gods aren't just stuck in ancient times. You know, these Greek gods are still living and occupying space in the modern world. I think it makes it a lot more believable, however believable the Greek gods can be.
I mean, obviously, younger audiences, you need to sort of tone everything down a notch, because Greek mythology is a bit intense, if you didn't know. And there's a lot of murdering and not very nice things. I mean, there still are in this book, but they've definitely taken it down a notch.
Oh, they've taken down, like, all of the sex that happens. Like, there's a lot of...
I mean, they've referenced it a little bit. Poseidon getting nasty in Athena's temple and all that good stuff.
And also, like, people killing their own children and, like...
And it's, like, everyone at this camp is related and they all just, like, fall in love with each other.
Oh my god, I never thought about that! How, like, Annabeth...
Annabeth and Percy are, like, cousins or something. Ooh! Like, it's so weird. It's
That's
so
really weird. That's really weird.
You just gotta take it, accept it, and not think about it. Like, maybe it's, like, if it's, like, godly relations, it just doesn't count.
Yeah, maybe, like, the gods don't actually have DNA. So it's, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're too good for DNA. The fact that everything's been toned down, even the sort of struggles of the gods. This whole book is framed about how Zeus is like, oh, I think my brother stole my toy. That is also a huge weapon. But, like, it's just, like, they're all grumpy family members just having family arguments. I love that you can take these huge mythological divine beings and be like, it's just a grumpy old man, like, at its purest form. Like, they're just angry family people.
Yeah. At Camp Half-Blood, they have 12 houses for the 12 gods and for the children of the 12 gods. And Artemis has sworn to never have children, but she still gets a house at Camp Half-Blood. And one of the characters says it's because, like, if she didn't have one, she'd be annoyed. And, like, no one's ever going to stay there. There's no point. But, well, she just actually wants it.
I'm going to call you out, Angari, because, spoiler, I'm, like, a few books ahead. I've read them all many times. Artemis has hunters, sworn soldiers, that are all 12-year-old girls that shoot arrows. Anyway, they come to camp and they stay there occasionally.
Okay, well, I'm sorry I didn't know about that. But, like, the gods are so petty. They're all so petty and vain and arrogant. Yeah, it's hilarious. And it totally is something that you can just make into this wild and wacky and fun kids book. It's very easy to do.
Yeah.
If you just take out, like, all the murder and stuff like that. Speaking of grumpy gods and families, this is a great way to transition into talking about the characters. So, first of all, we have our dear friend Percy Jackson. He is not only the hero of the story, but he is a hero.
Ooh.
Ooh.
I see what you did there.
See what I did there? For those of you who don't know, the traditional meaning of hero is someone who's, like, half divine. So, play on words there.
You're such a nerd.
Anyway, he is both a hero and the hero. And he's the troubled hero, and he's the chosen one. And this is something that we see a lot in fantasy books, is this idea of the chosen one. And it's usually a boy, and there's usually been some prophecy, and that is Percy.
Okay, there's sort of two sides of how I feel about that sort of character, where it's like that troubled hero with a huge destiny to save everyone. He's a good-ish role model. Yeah, because it's like he aspires to be a good person. That's basically his whole character. But then on the other side of things, it almost sets up kids to perceive that it's necessary to be this big grand figure. To have that destined prophecy is, like, a necessary part of being a good person almost in this book. Whereas, like, you know, it's cool to just be a good person. But then again, like, I love Percy and he's my favorite. And I'm pretty sure as a child, I just wanted to be Percy Jackson. Just like so bad.
I think it's interesting that like this chosen one trope has emerged and it happens so much. I mean, I don't read enough fantasy to like properly gauge the ratio of like chosen ones to not chosen ones. But I think it's interesting that a lot of it is to do with destiny and what you're destined to do. And Percy has this burden of this prophecy that Chiron, the centaur, who kind of takes care of all the kids at Camp Half-Blood, Chiron has heard this prophecy and Chiron thinks that Percy is like the one. We don't know what the one means. We don't know what he's destined to do. But there's this idea that his path is already laid out for him, except for the fact that Chiron says, Percy, you're the only one who can choose your path. But I'm also like, no, but he can't though. So while he's like the typical hero, I think he's the typical hero. There's something that he does, which I think is not typical of a hero, which I like. And it's when he has the opportunity to save his mother, but sacrifice himself or one of his friends. And he's in the underworld. Hades is like, I will save your mother, but you have to sacrifice one of you. And he decides to save himself. And if it were Harry Potter, that would have not happened. Yeah. And I like how he has this hero complex where he's like, I need to save everyone. I need to do everything correctly. But in that moment, he chooses to save himself, which I think is good and important. And it's like important to be selfish sometimes and to not do things for other people.
I think it's funny that you mentioned that because I would argue that it's not selfish. So I think the selfish thing to do would be to serve his own sort of idea of what's right. I.e. saving his mother. Like, I think that for him, it was picking over his own trials and tribulations, which was his mum being not dead, but captured, and the problems of the wider world. Because he knows that he has a bigger responsibility than just saving his mum. He has to save the world because he's the chosen one.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think it was about that idea of like, they were given these pearls and there were only three of them. So they could only three of them could safely escape. And he didn't do that thing of like, take me, you know, like, I'll, you know, save yourselves and like, I'll stay here. Which I think is cool and different.
Yeah.
Because that's often the way of the hero to say like, save yourselves. I'll sacrifice myself for you guys.
I mean, Percy's a bit of an idiot. Like, I love him. He's a great character, but we all know that Annabeth is the brains, yeah? Percy's a bit slow sometimes, but in that regard, you know, he's pretty smart sometimes.
He did good. Yeah. Is there anything else you want to say about Percy?
Something that I would like to talk about is the fact that these are 12-year-olds. Like, what?
I know.
In what world is a 12-year-old... Like, I mean, just a 12-year-old, like... catching a bus by themselves, like, should it be allowed? But like, three of them just like catching a bus to the other side of America to like go do some magic-y bull,
you can swear,
shit. like what? It's so weird. And like, they're not written as 12-year-olds. The characters are all childish in some ways, but I feel like it's the flaw of like basically every adult writing about children. They're not writing about children. They're writing about, you know, maybe teenagers and just calling them 12-year-olds. Percy Jackson he does not have the thought process of a 12-year-old. Like, 12-year-olds just think about like weird bad memes. They aren't thinking of like how to like slay a god. They'd be thinking about, you know, the latest...
Yeah, the latest cool hip trends.
Yeah, the fads of 2006. Not realistic. This book about Greek gods is just not realistic.
Our main complaint.
Yeah.
So in this story, we seem to have one villain. And at the beginning, we don't know who the villain is. The villain is obviously the person who has stolen Zeus's thunderbolt and is trying to start war between the gods. And they believe that that person is Hades. They go to Hades' underworld and they're like, oh, you don't have the thunderbolt. Whoops. Then who's the real villain? It's revealed that Ares is the villain, but he had an accomplice. He was working with someone. Hades and his accomplice, who we discover is Luke, who lives at Camp Half-Blood, worked together to steal Zeus's thunderbolt and then plant it in Percy's backpack so that Percy looked like the villain. And they were both serving a bigger villain. So really, we have three villains in this story. Three villains presented to us as the clear villains. So that's Ares. And then we discover he was working with Luke. And then Percy realizes that they've actually been serving a greater being, entity.
Who Percy dreams about, like, all the time. There's this stirring in the bottom of Tartarus, which is where the worst monsters are. It's Kronos, by the way. And his big bad lord of time, and is going to come and smite everyone.
Yeah.
Or he's going to try.
And they are all going to be smote by Kronos. So Kronos was, like, the OG. Well, Uranus was the OG.
Uranus was the sky. Gaia was the earth. They had babies many times. So they have a few different, like, sets of children. The giants, and then also the Titans. So the Titans are sort of the only ones that really feature in this series. But then the Titans have children, and they're the gods. And the gods then overthrew the Titans.
But after Kronos overthrew Uranus, his own father.
So Kronos is the father of Zeus, Poseidon, and Hades, who are like the big three. And they chop Kronos up and chuck him in the pit. Because yeah. They're like, we don't like you, daddy.
This book is riddled with kids having issues with their parents. Greek mythology is, in general. Because, you know, this is like really vulgar, but Kronos cut off Uranus's genitals and threw them in the ocean.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, so then his genitals were thrown in the ocean, and that's how Aphrodite was born. And then, here's the kicker though, Zeus did the same thing to Kronos. So it's like this whole thing of like, Kronos chopped up his father, and then Zeus chopped up his father. Where were we going with this?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, so we have the rumblings of Kronos, the Titan, and he's the big villain of them all, and he's gonna, you know, come back up again, I'm guessing. I have a strong inkling. But then we were talking about this before, about who's the real villain. Are the gods the real villains of the story, and everyone but the gods are the heroes?
I think Kronos, not good. Yeah, he's mean. He's in Tartarus for a reason. He's definitely the big bad, you know, but I don't think that excuses the gods. The gods are trash, to put it lightly. They're just all round not great people. Not that they're really people.
You're right, they're not. I mean, I was reading Mythos and I was like, oh, so I found my new favorite god. It's definitely Apollo. And then like he did something shitty and I'm like, oh, it's not Apollo anymore. So like every time I would think that I liked this god and thought they were cool, they would do something really terrible. And usually it's just punishing mortals who told them the truth. Athena is like one of my faves, but a mortal challenged her to a tapestry weaving contest and beat Athena, and Athena was so angry that she turned her into a spider.
What, like, why not? How else do you like vent your frustrations if you're a god? If you can't turn people into spiders, what are you supposed to do?
So they're all like so petty, but they also have good qualities.
It's all self-serving. It's like they don't want to end the world because the world is theirs. They're just protecting their property. Also, they're really mean to their children, and they all need counseling. Yeah. Can we talk about how Ares and Aphrodite are just like, to put it in a really friendly way, they're fucking on the DL, and it's not the DL. Like,
it's not the DL.
Hephaestus, or however you say his name, is just out here trying to catch them and put them on TV, going at it, because he's like, how else am I meant to get back at my wife who's just been cheating on me for thousands of years?
This is also the funny thing, is that like their children get caught up in this. Like, it's such a burden to place upon 12-year-olds, the idea of like 1,000-year-old grudges. So Annabeth, whose mother is Athena, is terrified of spiders, and spiders flock to her because of this 1,000-year-old grudge. And also like Athena and Poseidon have always had this like tiff going on, and Annabeth is like, me and Percy, like, we're not supposed to be friends because, like, you're the son of Poseidon. Like, what a burden to place on 12-year-old children.
But also, Percy starts a new one, a new grudge, because he feels the need to, like, fight Ares to, like, the maximum degree. So then all the Ares kids, like, hate him.
And also, he gets cursed by Ares, which, like, if there's one thing that I've learnt from reading the myths, is don't get cursed by a god. So, where was I going with this? I think the gods are the true villains, but I also think that they're interesting because they're flawed. They're kind of just like us, but with more power.
I mean, who doesn't love a bunch of mean trash bags flying around in the sky? I would love to just watch that dynamic. Because they literally, like, sit in a U on a mountain and just, like, get angry at each other. Like, that sounds like the best reality TV show. Hephaestus TV needs to get on that.
Oh my god.
Just record the gods and their family struggles.
Keeping up with Zeus and the Olympians.
Ew. Oh, I hate that so much.
Do we want to talk about, we've touched on it before, but, like, the prophecies?
Well, there's one and a bit prophecies in this.
Yeah.
Because there's the prophecy for this specific saga.
Oh my god, please don't tell me that there's a prophecy in every book.
Oh, there's a prophecy in every book.
I have such an issue with prophecies. I have such an issue with them.
Okay, I'm gonna fight you on this.
Oh my god, okay. There's a prophecy in this book. There's a mini prophecy that sets up Percy's quest. And then there's, like, this overarching prophecy that Chiron knows about, but we don't know about.
Okay.
So, the whole prophecy for a quest thing is, like, a thing. Whenever a hero goes on a quest from Camp Half-Blood, they go to the oracle and they get a prophecy. So sometimes the oracle is like, no, I'm not going to give you a prophecy. It's like this old mummified woman. And then other times she just, like, drives you insane. Like, it's always a bit of a gamble. Anyway, Percy gets a prophecy.
Can I read out his prophecy? Because I wrote it down here. Sure. His prophecy is, quote, "You shall go west and find the god who has turned. You shall find what was stolen and see it safely returned." Love how it rhymes. "You shall be betrayed by one who calls you a friend, and you shall fail to save what matters most in the end." End quote.
And Gary doesn't like prophecies, but I am a strong advocate for the prophecy because I think that it's an enticing way to sort of foreshadow events without completely giving them away.
As a literary device, I think a prophecy is a great idea. Like, fully, 100%. It reminds me a lot, I mean, I know I'm not the first one to say this, but, like, it reminds me a lot of the opening monologue in Romeo and Juliet, where he literally, like, tells the audience what's going to happen. And it's, like, also, like, showing the reader the end of the story and then, like, rewinding and seeing how people got to that point. So I love it as a literary device.
And Gary thinks that you can't break a prophecy. Is that what you think? Like, you think that the prophecy sets everything in stone? Is that your take?
No, this is not my take.
What's your take?
My take is that prophecies are too darn confusing.
Oh, okay. Well, I think that it's great because it's sort of like prophecy always comes true, right? I think, in this series at least. The prophecy is sort of set in stone, but they don't know how. And I think that's the great bit about it because everyone always gets so stressed about the prophecy. They're like, oh my god, it says that someone's going to die. And, like, yeah, someone's probably going to die. But, like, we don't know who. Like, there's so many options, you know?
I just don't like it because I'm like, would the prophecy have come true if he didn't know about it?
I mean, I would argue vaguely yes. It's a soft yes from me because the prophecy is what tells them to go west, I think. Like, they don't initially... Oh, no, but they know that they want to go to the underworld anyway.
Yeah, but it's like if they didn't know that they wanted to go west and then the prophecy is like, you shall go west, and then they go west and then everything happens. It's like, well, of course, because you told me to go west. So what if they just like, what if they heard the prophecy and decided to not go on the quest? Then the prophecy wouldn't come true.
But see, that's the thing. I would argue that the quest would happen because it's a prophecy. Yeah, so no matter what, something is going to happen that will now fulfill that prophecy. Like, they'd somehow get tricked into going on it by some other fort. Like, something would happen because it's a prophecy.
I just, my mind has never, like, gotten around that idea. Like, it's the same in Harry Potter. I just cannot, my mind cannot stretch like that.
Okay, so basically what we've learned here today is that Angari has a weak mind. And we don't accept her into the Percy Jackson fan club. That's kind of shameful for me to say that I'm in a Percy Jackson fan club. But
what's
you're not. You're not in the club.
Oh, What's your fan name then?
Oh, God.
A Jacksoner? An Olympian? Ew. You've been Olympian.
That's disgusting. I'm sure they have a name. Oh, Half-Blood, surely. Or something like that. Camper.
Sure, fine. I won't be in the Percy Jackson fan club. Jesus Christ. But here's the thing. The prophecy determines what Percy is going to do, right? Chiron knows about this prophecy. My thing is, like, what's the point if it's going to happen anyway? Like, what's the point of knowing it?
Because it helps.
Does it?
Yeah, because they're like, they need some guidance. So they're going to hit up that Oracle of Delphi. She's going to spit some mad green dust at them. And it's helpful. They have a vague outline of what they need to do. And also some, like, risk warnings. It's like, yo, someone's gonna die. You better, like, have someone ready to die, you know?
How much can Percy decide on his path, on what happens to him? Because we know that Chiron has heard this prophecy. The big prophecy that is gonna determine the outcome of Percy Jackson's life.
Not necessarily. We don't actually know that the big prophecy is about Percy. We, at this point, we just think that it's about Percy.
It may or may not have something to do with Percy. But either way, like, how much can he decide on what he does? Like, how much does he have control over his destiny?
There's mythical things at play. They aren't necessarily choosing their fate. Fate as a concept definitely exists in this world.
But at the end, Chiron says to Percy, and I quote, "No one can choose your path, Percy. You must decide," end quote.
But okay, so I reckon that there is a slight difference between path and fate. Because, like, even with the prophecy, it's like there's a set outcome. And there are certain things that are set in stone. Like, you know, things in prophecies, deaths, you know, the fates, the furies, they set that. But how you get there is your choice, almost. Like, that's sort of how I see it, at least in these books.
Okay. I guess that makes sense. We touched on this a bit before, but I want to bring it up. And I think this also relates to prophecies. The fact that these kids have such a burden placed upon them and they're carrying on the grudges and the traits of their parents. Like with Percy and Annabeth saying, like, we can't be friends because Poseidon and Athena have had this disagreement for thousands of years. I wonder, at the end of all this, if that structure will actually be upended and if Percy will kind of have this thing of, like, we don't have to, you know, live by our parents' rules. Like, we can be friends with whoever we want. Because it's a really divisive community, you know. It's the Ares kids hate everyone and Hermes kids are friends with everyone and Poseidon and Athena don't like each other.
I mean, I think it's interesting, but I also do think that there is a degree of separation that they have from the gods. Because, like, I mean, obviously, just in Annabeth and Percy, like, over the course of the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, they become friends. I think that while there might be, like, sort of grudges and stuff, I think that overall, it's still, like, they are their own people, and they all know that.
But how do you think it affects them staying in Camp Half-Blood when they're actually, when they're divided into these separate houses, and, like, Percy's just chilling in Poseidon's house by himself, and then you've got the gang of Ares kids and the gang of Hermes kids, and... Because I think that it has this divisive effect on the kids.
What? It's like high school, but on crack.
Yes!
It's like the most cliquey. Do you think that there's cliques within the cabins? There's probably not enough of them. No. Maybe in Hermes, because there's a lot of them. Anyway, it's like high school. Percy doesn't really in the first book. Mm. But, like, going forwards, there's more connections, I think, between other cabins.
Mm. In this next segment, called Prejudice and Prejudice, we discuss the representation, or sometimes lack thereof, of marginalized groups in the text. For Percy Jackson, we want to talk about learning disabilities and ADHD, because Percy Jackson has ADHD and dyslexia, and this is referenced multiple times throughout the text, and it's canon. When I was researching this, Rick Riordan actually created this character for his son, who also was diagnosed with ADHD and dyslexia. He created this character with those traits so that his kid could relate. So do we want to talk about how these two things are represented and how they define or don't define Percy as a character and as a hero?
I think it's great. In Percy Jackson, they talk about how, you know, the ADHD is, like, good battle reflexes and the dyslexia is because their brain is hardwired for ancient Greek. And like, yeah, that's probably not the most accurate representation of these disabilities, but like, it's still sort of reframing it as like, hey, maybe these things aren't necessarily bad. You know, not to minimize the struggle, because Percy does struggle with it, but to say there might be benefits to these things as well, you know, and it's still just like part of the character.
It's interesting how, like, in the final battle that Percy has with Ares, his ADHD becomes something that he uses and that he harnesses to defeat Ares. There's this quote here, quote, "My senses were working overtime. Now I understood what Annabeth had said about ADHD keeping you alive in battle. I was wide awake, noticing every little detail," end quote. It becomes part of how he acts as a hero and who he is as a hero. It's truly part of his character, and it doesn't feel like something that's been added as an afterthought. In this segment, which is titled Feminist or Nah, we ask ourselves the question, is Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief by Rick Riordan feminist or nah?
Feminist?
Nah?
Okay.
Asterisk. There's always an asterisk. Yeah. There's always an explanation.
I wouldn't call this, you know, feminist literature right here. But I think that inherently it carries some sort of feminist ideology. Because you have these female characters that are not really held back by some of the same limitations that other female characters are in some texts. You have Annabeth, who is the daughter of Athena. Like, there's an entire goddess of wisdom and being smart. Then Clarice is daughter of Ares. So on the opposite side of the spectrum, you have this sort of meathead, brute force...
Bully.
And, like, she's not necessarily a good character, but she sort of shows that women can be strong, you know, like, physically strong, strong-willed, you know. So you have these different sort of female characters representing different types of women, but, like, there's definitely flaws.
Yeah, I think that it's so difficult with a book like this, you know. We're not talking about A Room of One's Own, which is all about feminism and women's issues, and it's tough when you're looking at a text that doesn't have feminism or activism as a theme, because it makes it a lot less clear. I think that there's nothing ultimately sexist about it, but I don't think there's anything super feminist about it either. I think that Annabeth is a good role model, and I think she's a well-rounded, interesting female character, but that should also just be standard. it's like you can't just have, like, all the male characters are, like, interesting, and then you just, like, half-ass all the female characters. You know, it shows that Rick Riordan is a good writer. He's creating interesting and dynamic characters, and not all of them are men. So I appreciate that. I also think it's worth pointing out that the hero is still a boy, and that happens all the time in fantasy. You know, you have this male hero. Her character, she says, like, I've been waiting for a quest for, like, however many years, like 5 years, and I haven't gotten one yet, and I've been training and training. And then Percy comes in and is like, sup, and, like, gets a quest straight away. And she has a prophecy, doesn't she, that, like, she has to wait for the right person to take her on a quest, and it just turns out to be this boy.
I think it's she knows that she is somewhat involved in the bigger prophecy, I think, or something like that. Like, she, I don't know, there is some underlying thing of she has to be taken on a quest.
Yeah. So it's like, she goes on the quest, but it's not her quest. And I think that there's a firm difference there. So yeah. It's tough, because there are both arguments and there are both sides, and it's really difficult to look at something like this when it's actually not the point of the book. You know, it's not trying to be this feminist manifesto, you know, that's not what it's here for. We're here for a good time. And we're not that you can't have a good time with a feminist manifesto, but we're here for action and adventure, and it's great that there's a girl in there and she's part of the action and the adventure, but ultimately it is Percy's story, you know, it's not hers. So this is the epilogue. This is where we share our final thoughts, our final rating. So Harry, what is your rating of the book?
So I have two ratings, because I can't decide on anything. The child in me, by which I just mean me, 5 stars. Like, honestly, I've complained a lot during this episode, I feel like, but I love this book so much. It's so, so near and dear to my heart. But, like, from a practical standpoint, it's probably closer to a 3 or a 4. But, like, it's a 5.
You know what? I actually do have very similar feelings. It's tough to compare it with like other five-star books that I've read this year.
But like bearing in mind that it's for a children's book, it succeeds at what it's trying to
do. Exactly. For what it sets up, it does it perfectly. And I'm like, yeah, this is five-star for its genre, for its time, for its themes, for its characters. But like, you know, at the end of the year, I write down all the books that I read and which ones were five stars and I highlight them all. So
I'm such a nerd.
I think for me, it's kind of like a 3.5. I enjoyed it. Like I read it in 3 days, flew through it. It was so much fun. I was, you know, laughing, like really fun action adventure, but it's not my new favorite book.
It's my old favorite book and my new favorite book.
But like, it's so tough when you're not the target audience, because my reading has expanded so much since I first read the book. So before we go, is there anything you would like to plug?
Follow my Instagram. My Instagram is Harry Lowe. It has 3 R's in the Harry, and Lowe is spelled L-O-W-E. I need the clout. Please follow me.
This is the only reason Harry is coming on the podcast, is so that people follow him on Instagram.
Oh, fully. I hope that she shouts me out on a Instagram story as well, because yes. I need the clout. Although Instagram doesn't even show you the likes anymore. So like my clout dreams have been crushed. It's very sad.
I love how you're also like unabashedly like just here for people to follow you. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe on iTunes so that you never miss an episode. You can also rate and review on your podcast platform of choice. You can follow the community library on Instagram at @the_community_library, and you can use the hashtag #thecommunitylibrary on Instagram or Twitter. The podcast artwork is designed by Ashley Running. You can visit her website at ashleyrunning.com, or you can go to helio-press.com, that's dash the symbol. Once again, thank you for listening. Thanks for hanging out with me, Harry.
Bye.
Bye. 'Hey guys, it's me, Editing Angauri, again. Bet you didn't think you'd see me here, but I'm here to tell you that there are no bloopers at the end of this episode because I am creating a whole bonus episode. This bonus episode is going to come out next week, and it's just going to be me and Harry talking about stupid stuff that is mildly related to Percy Jackson, but really not at all. So I'll talk to you next week.